All right, well, this is the plan, is this is the last one, right? We're going to try to finish up, second and third John tonight, which is a little ambitious, but last week we, you know, these studies have a decent amount of intro material before you even get to the text. So I think we spent a good bit of time last time, you know, introducing the books, and we said they touch on some of the same themes as First John. Another reason why you can go through them fairly rapidly, because they touch on some of the same things. And we talked about the idea of truth and love. Okay, and we said that, you know, the world defines truth and love in different ways often than God does, and that's where we get into trouble. And even in our modern times, people can see truth and love as opposed to each other. You know, like they're two different things, but of course they're really not. And they go hand in hand. So we're going to continue to see that tonight. And we got a little bit into 1 John. I think we did the first six verses. And we said 2 John. And we said 2 John is written basically, it's the elder, that is, you know, John, the pastor, basically to the elect lady, that is the church. So again, he's in Asia Minor, based out of Ephesus later in his life. And so this letter is addressed to basically the church, at least one congregation, maybe the church in general. And when we get to 3 John, we're going to see that's different, you know, how it's addressed to. Okay, but this is addressed to, you know, a group of people. So we talked about that, and we talked about the warnings that that he gives. And so let's go ahead and jump to the rest of the book. With verse 7. So we're going to read 7 through 13, and then there's several things we're going to talk about with that. So 2 John, again, no chapter divisions in either of these. They're basically just, you know, one chapter, just the verses. But so I want to read 7 through 13, the rest of 2 John. Okay?
For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourselves that we lose not those things which we have wrought, but we receive a full reward. Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he hath both the Father and the Son. If there come any unto you, and bring not this doctrine, receive them not into your house, neither by him Godspeed. For he that abideth him, Godspeed, is partaker of his evil deeds. Having many things to write unto you, I would not write with paper and ink, but I trust to come unto you and speak face to face, that our joy may be full. The children of thy elect sister greet thee. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so he ends with amen there, and a closing. And we'll see 3 John ends in a similar way, in that he's basically saying, I'm writing to you now, but what does he hope to do soon?
To
see them in person, face to face, where he can discuss it. So he's sending them these letters, and like I said, we'll see 3 John ends basically in the same way. Let's see, make sure I got that. Yes, okay, yeah, we're going, the recording going. So you know, he's hoping to see them in person, and of course, this is before our modern age of FaceTime and all these different things, Zoom and text messages. So, you know, letters were the way you communicated with people from a distance. But, you know, you definitely wanted to see them face to face. All right. So we do see some of these themes here. In the question number 11, John states that deceivers refuse to confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Why do you think that John singles out this doctrine as key? Okay, I think we've talked about this before, this is kind of a review, but most theologians think he's writing against what here? What heresy?
Romans?
Well, Romans, yeah, but the Gnosticism. Okay, this idea, well, this is the Roman Empire, but really a lot of coming is coming out of the Greek philosophy, but Gnosticism. Remember Gnosticism? And we've talked about that several times, but the Gnostics saw what as bad? Flesh, right. So the Gnostics are saying flesh is bad. Okay, the flesh is bad. And so what doctrine are they going to have trouble with then, the Gnostics? They're not going to like this doctrine too much.
The
Right. So he says right there in verse 7, deceivers are entered into the world, which confess not that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and antichrist. And again, we see that antichrist language again, right, that we saw in first John. So the Gnostics, a lot of the early heresies, I think we've talked before, have to deal with, mostly today we're dealing with people who deny that Jesus was God, right? They'll say he was a good man, or he was a teacher who captivated people and us. But back then, a lot of the early heresies are denying that Jesus has come in the flesh as man. Okay, so that's what he's addressing here, is, you know, the Gnostics are denying the human nature of Jesus. Not just the Gnostics, but they were pretty prominent. So what we, again, this is something we kept coming back to. John is emphasizing the dual nature of Christ, that Christ is true God and he is true man, right? And you have to have both of those things right, to be a Christian, to be a follower of God. You have to confess that Jesus has come in the flesh and that he has come as God, not one or the other. And I know we've talked about this before, but why? Why is that such a big deal? Why do we have to have a Jesus that's both God and man? Other than the Bible says so, so that's what we should believe, obviously. But.
Well, I mean, only God can do your righteousness. He's the only one who can take away your sins.
Right.
Body and blood was needed.
Right. So,
yeah, die on the cross.
Right. Between the two of you, you got it. So we have to have Jesus as God because only God is perfect. Only a God could not, you know, to be the perfect sacrifice, could not sin, right? To be without sin. But as David said, we have to have a true man, Jesus, because he has to have flesh and blood that he can offer as the sacrifice for sin, right? If he doesn't have this, like the Gnostics are saying, then he can't be the atonement for our sin because he can't die, he can't bleed, he can't, you know, suffer, and he can't die. Okay, so this is one of the essential doctrines of Christianity. If you don't believe this, you're outside of orthodoxy. You would not be considered a Christian because you're denying one of the essential things that we need there. Okay, so he keeps coming back to that, but we see that again. You know, you got to watch out for these people that are coming and telling you this stuff because they're antichrist, they're deceivers, and they're not giving you the truth. So again, Christianity is the only true religion. It's the only true way to God, and we don't say that as like a ha ha, we're right and you're wrong thing. We say that because that's the truth. And that's the only answer. You know, all the other religions, their answer to the problem of sin is inadequate, isn't it? It's inadequate. It doesn't work. Okay? It doesn't work. You have to have a perfect sacrifice to pay for people's sins because we can't do that ourselves. We can't be perfect. Okay? But at the same time, we have to have a sacrifice that can really bleed and die. So the reason Christianity is true is because only the true God can do that. Okay, there's no other, you know, it's not personal, it's just the truth, okay? That because you can't do it any other way. Okay, this is the only way that sin can be paid for, and that's why it's, again, you see a lot of echoes from the Gospel of John here too. John 14:6, one of my favorite Bible verses, Jesus answers. They say, you know, I think it was Thomas. Maybe I'm wrong. Asked the question, well, how are we going to get there, Jesus? And Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. Okay, so you have to go through Jesus to be reconciled to the Father. That's the only way, is what Jesus is telling them. Okay. You also see throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus is. His divinity is very clear in that gospel. And what does he say on numerous occasions? Basically, if you want to be a true follower of God, of Yahweh, you have to come through me. If you can't know the Father without knowing me, basically. Okay, so that's what John is saying here. You know, if we receive the full reward, well, how do we do that? We have to come through the true Jesus of the Bible, who is God and man. Okay, so if you want to be a follower of God, if you want to be reconciled to God, you have to confess the Jesus of the Bible. Okay, the one that is true man and true God. And so again, in this passage here, we see a lot of echoes of things that Jesus is teaching about in the gospel of, that John records as well. Okay? You know, you can't have the Father without the Son. Okay? Alright, but again, I think we talked about most of that. So let's go on to the next question, 117. And I've added a few other notes here, things I want us to look at in these verses that weren't questions here. But John says that the consequence of this erroneous belief is that such a person does not have God. John does not explicitly discuss love at this point, but what do you think, why do you think it would be difficult to have love without faith in the incarnation? Okay, why would it be difficult to have love without faith in the incarnation? Well, we got 1 John 4:19, God is love, okay? So to have true love, you have to have God, right? Okay? In the incarnation, how does that show us the love of God? Because what's happening in the incarnation? 9 months before Jesus is born.
That he was willing to come in the flesh.
Right, he's coming in the flesh. The incarnation is the point when Jesus becomes true man in the womb of the Virgin Mary. It's not when he's born, it's when he's incarnated. Again, that's one of the, so biblical supports of why we believe, life begins at conception. Because Jesus, when did Jesus become man, is when he was miraculously conceived in the womb of the Virgin Mary. That's what the Bible clearly teaches us. It wasn't when he came out of the womb, it was at the incarnation he took on human flesh. And again, scientifically, back then they didn't even understand that like we do today. Today we understand from the moment of conception when the two, the egg and the sperm come together and you have the life start, all the DNA is there. All the information is there for what that person will become. What color hair they're going to have, whether they're male or female. All of that's there. You can't even see it, but under a microscope. But all of that is there from the beginning. Again, they had no clue of that in the first century, but we do today. Okay, so at the moment of conception, this incarnation, God is coming down and he's taking on human flesh. Okay? And when I always think that's up there with creation. Maybe you could debate what's the greatest miracle, creation out of nothing or the incarnation. Because they're both incredible miracles, that if you believe those, I really don't think you have trouble believing any of the other miracles. Parting the Red Sea, well, that's a piece of cake compared to this, right? So God is becoming man inside the womb of a virgin in a form so small that you can't see it with the human eye. Okay? It's pretty incredible. Pretty incredible, isn't it? As a side note, I was talking to one of their teacher next door to me about this one day this week, and they were talking about Easter and, the date of Easter moves, but Christmas is always December 25th, right? Okay? Well, the belief going back to the early church is what day translated to our calendar did the incarnation happen? What day? Do the math. Coming up soon.
March 25th,
because December 25th is 9 months after after the incarnation. Okay, it's also believed by the early church that Jesus was conceived and died on the same day. That he was crucified on, would have been March 25th on our calendar, and that's the day the incarnation happened. Again, we don't have a specific Bible verse for that, but that goes back to the early church. Because there's kind of this misconception that Christians just kind of pirated Christmas from the Romans. The Romans had this Saturnalia festival to start the winter solstice. So when they became Christians, they just decided, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to make it the birth of Jesus. Like they just chose it out of thin air. Well, that's not really accurate because we actually have records of from the second century, way before this would even be an issue, of Christians celebrating in North Africa December 25th as Jesus' birthday. Okay, so it was not randomly chosen. They just counted 9 months from when they believed the incarnation. Now, am I going to build a church on that? No. Is it possible that he wasn't born on December 25th? That's possible. Okay, but there's a long history in the church that date is tied to the incarnation happening on March 25th, and that's a feast day in the church, a major feast day, and then 9 months from that would be Jesus' birth. Okay, so just a little side note there. So in the incarnation, this is an incredible miracle, you know, that God becomes man, and he does this out of love for his creation. It talks about in the epistles, he humbles himself. And when you think about that, that's pretty humbling when the creator becomes one of the creation, right? The creator is willing to go through all of these unpleasant things that we have in life and all the hardships of life and be hungry and be sad and all of these things to do that for us. Okay? So again, as I often say, Christianity is not just a spiritual faith. People say, well, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. Well, okay, you're missing part of it. Christianity is a flesh and blood religion and a spiritual religion. It's both. It's not, we don't downplay the physical. When Jesus rose from the dead, he had a body. On the last day, we will have a glorified body. Okay, so Jesus came not only to redeem our souls, but he came to redeem our flesh, to restore our flesh. When he created Adam and Eve, they weren't just ghosts floating around the Garden of Eden. They had bodies. And so that was God's intention from the beginning for man, was to have a body. Okay, he could have just made us as, you know, spirits or whatever, but he said, no, this creation is going to have a physical body. So when if we downplay, or the Gnostics even, they're denying the fleshly part, you're missing a whole part of Christianity there. You're missing a whole big piece of it there, because it's about redeeming not only our souls, but our bodies as well. Okay? Any other comments with that? All right. Now, it doesn't address this in the study guide, but I think this is interesting. So let's talk about this. The verses there where it talks about in verse 9, we've already talked about, if he does not abide in the doctrine of Christ, he doesn't have God. If you don't have the doctrine of Jesus right, you don't have God. Why in the Missouri Synod do we say there may be some very nice people that are Latter-day Saints or that are Jehovah's Witnesses, but we do not consider them Christians? We do not consider them Orthodox Christians. Why not? Well, there's probably several reasons, but the main reason is they've got Jesus wrong, don't they? They don't have the Jesus of the Bible. So they're saying, you guys might be really nice folks, you know, and you're really zealous about getting your message out there, but what you're telling me about Jesus, that's not the Jesus I'm reading about in here. Okay, that's the main issue. Okay, and that's what John's saying. If you don't have the doctrine of Christ, you don't have God. You have to have the doctrine of Christ to have the Father. Okay? All right. Now, go on to verse 10 and 11 specifically. If there come any unto you, bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house. If they're not bringing the true doctrine, as in verse 9, neither bid him Godspeed, for he that biddeth him Godspeed is a partaker of the evil deeds. So what is John writing here to the church? Again, this is written to at least a congregation, probably a group of congregations, this elect lady. What is he saying in those verses about these? If somebody comes preaching true doctrine, okay, you show them hospitality and welcome them. But what if they come preaching false doctrine? Yeah, you don't welcome them. Okay, you don't welcome them. Okay, he says if you don't bid them Godspeed, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out, basically, you know, okay? You know? And he says you're partaking in their evil if you assist them. Okay? Alright, now what exactly does this mean? Well, I've heard this before. See, the Jehovah's Witnesses come to your house, right? Like they like to do. And they want to talk to you, right? People will say, don't let them into your house. You can talk to them at the doorway, but don't let them into your house, which may be wise. And what is their support for that going to be?
Because you're allowing them.
These two verses right here. Okay, these two verses right here, they're going to say, well, you're inviting, you know, these false people into your home. And I think that may be wise, you know, but at the same time, we have to look at the context of these verses. I don't know if I would ever say you can never let a Jehovah's Witness or Mormon or anything into your house and talk to them. You certainly wouldn't want to probably like prepare a big deal for them and let them live there and base their operations out of your house. But where did Christians meet at this time when John is writing this under the inspiration of the Spirit? In homes. Okay? So when John is writing this, he's saying don't welcome them. You know, don't give them basically a platform. You know, don't give them room and board and stuff. He's really speaking about the churches. Okay? When he's saying, you know, if somebody is coming and brings not the true doctrine, not this doctrine, receive them not into your house, neither bid them Godspeed. Really, the most accurate context here, this is talking about basically a church. Because, yeah, the church was meeting in people's homes. Usually, like the wealthiest person in your congregation had the biggest house. That's probably where you'd want to meet, because they had the most amount of space. So the direct context here, you think, don't let those people in. Don't let them speak in the church. Don't, you know, give them money. Don't support them. And just tell them, you got to go somewhere else. Don't give them a foothold. So, while I certainly respect that position, people that will cite these verses, I wouldn't draw like too hard of a line there, because they weren't talking about just like homes people were living in only. They were talking about the church, basically. And certainly in the church, we would not want like a false teacher to come in and give them a platform, right? That's a no-no. And that's even to the point of, well, maybe they're even Christians, but at the same time, if I'm not going to be here, the person that I'm going to secure to fill in, I want to make sure that they check all the boxes, so to speak. You know, that's why we, you know, I don't just grab like, oh yeah, you're like a retired Baptist preacher, why don't you come in and fill in for me Sunday? And we want to make sure it's like somebody who's, you know, a Missouri Synod pastor or somebody that we're in fellowship with, okay? So we want to make sure that we're, you know, that we're to follow that. I think that's really what we're doing, is we're not giving people a platform to speak that are teaching false or erroneous doctrines, and we're also not financially supporting that. Okay, when we give our money to missions, it should be to like an Orthodox, you know, group that's teaching the truth about Jesus, right? Not, you know, they might be doing good things. They might be, you know, feeding the poor, whatever. But we want to make sure, as the church, the financial and the prayer support and everything we're giving to people is going for people who have, you know, Orthodox beliefs. Okay? So I think that's really the direct context here that it's talking about. So I had made a few notes about that. You know, we don't basically say don't show hospitality to false teachers. Okay, don't show hospitality to false teachers. Don't encourage them. You know, don't support them. Okay? All right, now, something that's very important in the church, especially to us Lutherans, what else could this have implications for what we're reading about right here? What important part of the life of the church? Could this have implications for?
Cannot have people misled.
Not have people misled. All right. What about what is the thing that we do that has a whole lot to do with fellowship and union?
Communion.
Yeah. Right, so you could tie this into communion as well, like the fellowship and communion. Why are we kind of funny, for lack of a better word, about that? You know, making sure, you know, the people are communing with us that share the same confession of faith. I think this would go to that as well. You know, we want to make sure, again, if every person in every church had to agree on every single thing, there would never be communion, right? Okay, no church could ever have communion, right? Probably. That has more than two people. Even then, maybe, probably not, right? They disagree on, the husband and wife, they're going to disagree on something, you know? But we want to make sure we're sharing the same confession of faith on the essentials and the things that God teaches us specifically in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11 that are needed for fellowship in the Lord's Supper. Okay, we want to make sure we're agreed on those things. Because remember, when we commune, we're not just communing with God. Yes, we're communing with God, but we're communing with everyone else, right? Right. So it's a sign that we are in fellowship. We are in agreement with each other. That's why we share the peace. That's why we say the creed. before we commune, right? Because we're saying this is what we believe. Okay? So I think it ties into that as well. I wrote down page 340. I was going to read, I think, a couple things here about this here on page 340, and then we'll move on to 3 John. The first century church knew that John knew met in various locations. City churches often met in the houses of wealthy people as the center of public worship and distribution of money and food. This is the context in which John employs language of hospitality. The early church had to deal with false teachers who came to congregations claiming special teaching directly from the Lord. Oftentimes these were itinerant preachers looking for money, food, and lodging. And there's a very ancient document called the Didache from the 2nd century where we learn a lot about the early church, and it references that. John's warnings include the admonition not to give such preachers hospitality unless they bring this teaching, that Jesus was God incarnate, true God and true man in one person. Not only should the congregation not allow such falsehood into their house, but they should also avoid giving such a false teacher any greeting rather than rebuke false teachers and warn others against their deceptions. This is exemplified in the narrative of John at the bathhouse recorded by Eusebius. John, the disciple of the Lord, going to bathe in Ephesus and seeing Cerinthus within, ran out of the bathhouse without bathing, crying, "Let us flee, even if the bath fall, because Cerinthus, the enemy of the truth, is within." So I love that. That's from the Didache. So there's this, John is pointing to, people go to bathhouses, they still do in the Middle East oftentimes. And this false teacher guy was there, he ran out of the bathhouse. I don't want to take a bath with this guy because God might strike this building and it falls down on top of him. So that's a great little story there. Luther noted that the rules of hospitality apply to the communion rail as well. We learn from all these things how the ban from communion should be used. First, we should seek neither vengeance nor our own gain, as is now the shameful custom everywhere, but rather the improvement of our neighbor. Second, punishment should not stop short of his ruin or death, for St. Paul limits the goal of the ban to his improvement. But he that put to shame because no one associates with him, and he adds in 2 Thessalonians 3:15, do not look on him as an enemy, but punish him as a brother. At the present time, the ruthless tyrants deal with people as if they wish to cast them into hell and do not seek their improvement as well. So Luther is reminding all of this, it's not done to harm people, it's not done to put down people, but it's done to protect the church, and it's ultimately to try to witness to the person, okay, and get them to confess the true doctrine, okay? So anyway, so I thought there were some interesting things in the commentary about that. All right, let's go, anything else on 2 John? If not, we can go to 3 John. Okay, let's go to 3 John. And there's the little introduction that says, this letter deals with support and opposition within the congregation to which John is writing. Now, this letter is different than 2 John for a very obvious thing right at the beginning. It starts out very similar. The elder unto, but who is this written to?
Gaius.
And so it's written to an individual. Okay, and actually in this letter we will see 3 individuals' names in this letter. Okay, so where 2 John is writing to the elect lady as the church, as a broader group, this letter is directly addressed to this Gaius, person, okay, who welcomed a group of Christian missionaries. John cites this as evidence of God's love. On the other hand, there is a man named Diotrephes, who refused to welcome the brothers. Okay, and then we're going to see there's a guy named Demetrius a little later. Okay, so we see individuals mentioned, called out by name here by John in this letter. All right, so let's read the first 8 verses of this. Someone want to read the first 8 verses of 3 John?
The elder to the beloved Gaius, to my love and truth, beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it does well with your soul. For I rejoice greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Beloved, it is a faithful thing you do in all the efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testify to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. For they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth.
Okay, so there is a precedent in the New Testament for missionaries sometimes to depend on the people of goodwill for their physical needs. Where do missionaries get their support according to the following passages? Okay, well, this one's a little longer, but if we maybe turn to Matthew chapter 10, we can at least summarize that. Let's see what happens. So, what Jesus is doing here in Matthew 10 is he's sending out the disciples. Okay? And he says, go, he sends out the 12 and he says, go not into the way of the Gentiles, into any city of the Samaritans, enter not. This time he's sending them to the Jews, the house of Israel first. And he's telling them heal, you know, cast out demons. And what does he tell them to take with them?
Nothing.
Nothing really. You know, basically just kind of the clothes on their back. Because who is going to support them? The God is through the people they encounter. He says, if you go into a city or town and inquire, and it is worthy, and thereby go thence, and ye shall come into a house saluted. If the house be worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if not worthy, let your peace return to you. And whosoever shall not receive you, nor hear your words, when you depart out of your house or city, shake off the dust of your feet. Kind of sounds like what John's saying in 2 John, wasn't it? You know, don't even just tell them, go on down the road here. Okay? Alright? Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. That's pretty bad. Okay? So, they're not rejecting you. You, per se, they're rejecting me. They're rejecting the gospel. So, basically, Jesus sends the disciples out, doesn't tell them to take a whole lot of supplies, and he says, hey, if people receive you, you stay with them. If they don't, you don't. Okay? Alright? So the disciples are to stay in the towns where they are welcomed, where they are received. Okay? 2 Corinthians 12, 14 through 18. Let's turn to that. And 2 Corinthians deals a lot with money and giving, actually. A lot of good stewardship stuff in 2 Corinthians. So we got 12, 14 through 18. Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for their parents, but parents for their children. And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. But be it so, I did not burden you, nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. Did I make a gain of you by any of them whom I sent to you? Okay, so Paul did not basically accept help from those that he was writing to. Okay? So he's being supported in other ways. And do you know what did Paul do to earn money? He was kind of bivocational too. He was a tent maker. Remember, he was a tent maker. So he actually worked you know, at times along this missionary journey. Like in Corinth, he stayed there for a year and a half. So he wasn't just saying, I'm going to lounge here and y'all give me all your, you know, I'm just going to like mooch off you guys. He was like working. Okay? And he actually connected with people that had the same, you know, trade as him. Okay? The last one there is 1 Thessalonians 2:9. That's just one verse. So I want to read that, 1 Thessalonians 2:9. Okay.
For you remember, brothers, our labor and toil. We worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you, while we proclaim to you the gospel of God.
Right. So, if you want to be a missionary, do you expect to get rich? No. If that is your goal, to make a lot of money, don't become a missionary. I think that's pretty clear from the Bible, because, you know, you obviously need to have the things you need, okay? But, you know, you're not really supposed to be kind of living it up in luxury here. That's not what you're doing it for, okay? So you are often supported by the people, you know, by people in the church, okay? But, you know, you're supposed to work as well, okay? You know, again, there's a lot of debate about this, how we fund missions, you know, in the church. And so I don't say you can't do that, but, you know, there's only a certain amount of money. And, you know, there are times when the synod or a district may provide money for a mission. They may say, you know, we're going to give you X amount of dollars to go be a missionary here, or this X amount of dollars to start a church, okay? And, you know, that's very generous, okay? But then there are other times when money is short and they say, well, we're not going to be able to do that. You need to go around and you need to speak to churches and get them to support you and things like that, okay? So there's kind of a variety of ways, but actually I was, you know, what we see in the New Testament is, you know, it's kind of nice to have like a big bankroll from synod or district, but I mean, there's a lot of biblical support for that not being the way it's done. Because, you know, you see these missionaries going out having to rely on, you know, the people they're ministering to for food, you know, and to work sometimes. So it's a difficult thing. Okay. So I'm not saying we can't do that. If we have the funds, it's kind of nice to do that. And certain environments might require more support than others, but at the same time, I mean, in the Bible, we certainly see other models of that. We don't see the Church of Jerusalem just giving a big grant to Paul, you know, for, okay, here's money for 5 years, you know, we're paying for everything. I mean, that's not what was happening, okay? Given the example of Paul in the last two passages, it may be that traveling missionaries did not always feel comfortable asking for support. How does offering such support, even when it is not asked for, benefit not only the recipient, but the giver as well?
Well, it just shows your love. I mean, it's both ways. I mean, I'm sure the missionary feels the love of somebody giving something, and the person giving it, you know, it's better to give than receive.
I mean, it's
unselfish thing. You have to think about it, maybe pray about it, and you're giving something of your own free will that God would want you to do.
Yeah, I think, and that's like everything else, you know, as Christians we're supposed to be doing, we should be supporting missions because we get to, not because we got to, right? Give that missionary again. You know, it should be a joyous thing that, and it's like I said, it's benefiting us, it's benefiting the church, it's growing the church, it's getting the gospel out there so more people can be saved from death and hell. And so it's a good thing, it's a good opportunity to do that, to support missionaries and to support missions. And it should make us, you know, feel good as Christians that we're doing that. The other thing is, not everybody is called to be a missionary, right? Right? Okay, you're laughing, right? Not everybody's called to be a missionary, right? But maybe if you're not called to be a missionary, maybe you can't even do it due to health reasons or something like that. Or what can you do? You could support missionaries financially. You could pray for them, certainly. Okay, so just like not everybody's called to be in full-time church work, not everybody's called to be a missionary. Okay, professionally. Now, we're all supposed to be missionaries in the sense we're spreading the gospel, right? Where God places us. And I'm talking about someone who, like, does that full time or most of the time. But we can certainly support them. Okay, we have the Gideons come every May, right? And they go all over the country. They go all over the world. Places that probably most of us will never go. But we support them, right? We support them with our gifts. And then they can go out and buy Bibles and do that. And really, we're just buying the Bibles and Testaments, right? We're not even, like, paying them to do it. You know, they're doing it kind of like we read in these passages. They're not getting rich off of this. Okay, they're not making any money from it. They're giving up their time, but we're paying for the scriptures that they give out. Okay? So it talks about missionaries here. So we should financially support missionaries and pastors and church workers in doing that. Okay, let's see. I had another thing from the commentary here. It's actually from verse 12, I believe. So we're going to read the next section here before we get to that. Let's go to 3 John here. See if there's anything else in these first 8 verses that I wanted to get from the commentary. I think we got out the main things here. Okay. So does someone want to pick up with verse 9 and read to the end of the book?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay.
I wrote unto the church, but Theophilus, who loved to have the presence among them, received us not. Wherefore, if I come, I'll remember his deeds which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith. Neither doeth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and cast them out of the church. Beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, that he that doeth evil hath not seen God. Demetrius hath good report of all men, and of the truth itself. Yea, and he and we also bear record, and ye know that our record is true. I have many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee. But I trust I shall shortly see thee, and we will speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute thee. Greet the friends by name.
Okay, so we saw in the first 7 verses, we see this guy, Gaius here, is commended, right? And he's commended because he, you know, receives these missionaries and supports them. But then we see another guy here who is not commended, right? Diotrephes here is the opposite of Gaius. Because what does he do?
He doesn't welcome
them. Yeah, he refuses to welcome them as brothers. But his problem is not only with love. How does John imply that Diotrephes has a problem with the truth as well?
Malicious words and contempt.
Yeah, malicious words and contempt, things like that, right? Verse 9, the ESV says he does not acknowledge our authority. The King James says he receives us not. Okay, so it's translated there. So he is not receiving whose authority here? Whose authority is he rejecting and not receiving?
God.
Ultimately God. But John in the, you know, in the human context, but by rejecting John's authority, he's rejecting the message that he brings. Right? He's rejecting the message that John brings. And what is the message that John's bringing? Jesus. The message of God, right? So that's why Diotrephes here is condemned, not just because he's not nice to John initially, but by rejecting them, by not showing them the hospitality like Gaius did, he's rejecting the message that they bring. Okay, he's rejecting the message that they bring. Okay? And that's very serious. So that's why he is condemned here. Again, we're seeing people named by names here. Okay? By name. And saying, okay, this is commended. This person is condemned because of what they have done. Okay? So you might have, say, someone is rejected, they just don't like the person or whatever, but when you reject certain people, you're rejecting their message too. Okay? Let's say you're in a church and you particularly may not even care for the pastor that much, maybe you don't get along with the pastor, you don't like the personality. Well, that's a different thing than, but you shouldn't reject the pastor if he's preaching the truth, right? Because if you just like kind of kick him out of the church because he's not the style that we like or whatever, well, you're removing the person who's bringing the message of God and administering the sacrament. So sometimes we can get tied up in kind of personality issues and who we like or don't like. But the key thing that he's concerned about here is that he's rejecting the message that John is bringing, okay, and by doing that, he's rejecting the gospel, okay, all right, So that it's more serious than just a personality conflict. Okay? Alright? It's like, you know, as a teacher, okay, student maybe doesn't like the teacher, but okay, but if you don't listen to anything the teacher says and don't learn anything, well, you're also rejecting what they're trying to teach you. Okay, you're not gonna learn what you need to learn. And the same thing in the church, if you're rejecting John, you're also rejecting the message that he's bringing, because if you don't let him come in there and teach and speak, then he can't, he's the one God has sent to bring you the gospel. Okay. Alright, then there's another guy here mentioned. Who's the third name that we see dropped here in 3 John?
Demetrius.
Now what about Demetrius?
He says the right word. He's got the truth.
Right, so Demetrius is commended. So we see one person, condemned, and we see two people commended here. Because we do see Demetrius is brought in. He has good report with all men and of truth. He will bear record, and we will know our record is true. Okay, so Demetrius is commended here as, you know, receiving the truth and making it possible for the truth to be shared. Okay? I was going to read a quote from Luther from the commentary here as well. I thought that was helpful here. When it talks about, you know, who is commended and who is rejected. Luther writes, a bishop should listen and answer gently. He should advise prudently. He should not insist on his own way. He should use good common sense so that it will be a pleasure to behold it. He is not noisy. He is not rash. Everything is done with good common sense. Hospitable. He is a cheerful host to brothers who come from everywhere, from churches and other places. He gives them food and drink. He washes their feet. Indeed, the bishop's home should be open to foreign brethren, but not just to any vagrant. At the time of the Roman Empire, this was not so. And the political community of the Jews, in a very fine way, wrote letters of recommendation for their brethren. We read about this in John's last epistle. So again, back to this idea of hospitality, Luther is saying that the bishop, the pastor, needs to be welcoming, right? He needs to be welcoming to people and receiving the true teachers, showing them hospitality, a place to live and stay, and food and things like that. Okay? We actually, I don't know if he's the next guy coming. We have a guy coming to our Airbnb who is an evangelist, and he's going to be speaking at the Hull Baptist Church, And so we were contacted, and who's paying him to stay in our Airbnb?
Their church.
The church that has invited him, right? So they're showing him hospitality, and they're giving him a place to stay while he comes and ministers with them. Okay, so we get all kinds of people down there, but we actually have a traveling evangelist who's going to come. But it was the pastor of the Hull Baptist Church that contacted Shoshana and said, hey, we got this guy coming, and he's going to be staying with you. You know, so they're putting him up there. So what John's saying, what Luther's saying, you'll be like Demetrius here, okay? Be like Demetrius. Don't be like Diotrephes here, rejecting people, okay? Be welcoming if they're coming, bringing you the truth and help. And they shouldn't have to ask for you to take care of them, right? And that's where we get to some of those other verses. You know, Paul's like, well, I don't want you to do this or that. You shouldn't have to ask, okay? When someone is coming to minister in your church that's bringing the truth, they should be taken care of. Okay, the congregation should be doing that. Okay, they shouldn't have to come up to you and say, I'm here for a few days, I kind of need a place to stay. You know, they shouldn't have to do that. The church should already take care of that if they're coming in. Okay, all right. So that's what Luther is writing about here. You know, he says, give them food and drink, wash their feet, the bishop's home should be open, and all these kind of things. Okay? The conclusion here, okay, we're doing pretty good here. We got a couple of kind of concluding questions, but the conclusion, just one interesting thing to note, the number of verses varies depending on translation. In the King James, it's 14 verses. In the ESV, it's 15 verses. They split what the King James has as verse 14 into two verses. Okay, so in some Bibles, 3 John will have 15 verses. and some of it will have 14 verses. But this isn't even a textual variance, because if you read the words, they're the same. So I said we do have in the manuscripts, once in a while we do run across the textual variants. I think we looked at the one of those in 1 John, that's fairly, one of the more significant ones, or like the ending of Mark. But remember, the verse dividers are not divinely inspired. Even in Luther, it was after Luther's time those were put in. They had the chapters when Luther was around, but they didn't even have the verses yet. So it's not even a textual variance in the manuscripts, it's just how they divided the verses up. Two different people divided the verses up. But that's something you might notice, that there's 15 verses in some Bibles and 14 in another. Yeah.
Yeah, I've often thought about that, the verses that you come in until later, and I thought, what a nightmare. That's really possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so much easier, right? You have like the address, right?
No punctuation, no nothing.
Yeah. Well, and at Luther's time, at least they had the chapters, but if you notice in Luther's writings, he always says, as it says in whatever chapter. He doesn't say verse. If it does, that's at, like in the little quote that I read here. One of the quotes, it just said the chapter, then in parentheses, they had the verse, because that's it. So Luther never spoke of verses, because they wasn't divided. He just said the chapter. Now, why do you think it was right around the time of Luther, not long after he died, they put verses in? Like, so we could find stuff in our Bibles easier. Why did it take so long?
Because the church read everything, so
right.
It was important.
People didn't have Bibles to read.
And the printing.
Right, the printing press. Like, the Reformation changed on that. Now people are actually reading Bibles. They can have Bibles because they can be printed and they're allowed to read them as Protestants, right? So then it becomes necessary. So it's not like it just, they didn't get around to it for that long. It was needed then. It was needed because of the Reformation. So they decided to put verses in there so people could actually find stuff in the Bible a lot easier. Okay? So there's another little rabbit trail. Alright, how does he close the letter? Very similar to 2 John, right? He says, hey, this is great. I'm writing you with pen and ink, but I really want to see you. I really want to see you in person and talk to you in person. And again, even in our technological age, there's something about that, right? Like, we're gathered here tonight, and I think the pandemic reminded us of that, that there is something to be said for actual human interaction. If you're in psychology right now, your business is booming. I mean, if you know someone who's tried to get into therapy lately, but the psychologist, I mean, they're having to wait like 2 years sometimes for a specialist. Why? Okay, because everybody's having issues after the pandemic. I mean, it's a crisis, okay, especially with kids. I mean, I bet like, if I ask my classes, how many of you have mental issues? Like, over probably half of you raise your hand, It's off the charts, okay? So there is something to be said for human interaction, okay? And I think we've learned that. We're also seeing with the kids, why are they so behind in all their schooling? Well, they put them in all this online stuff, and a lot of them weren't doing anything. They weren't learning anything, okay? Right? Okay, and I say that as an online teacher. But we already had a system set up, and the courses were there, and they teach the standards, and kids were coming to us, like, intentionally. But when they just put everybody online, there wasn't a whole lot of learning happening, folks. And we're, as a teacher, we're seeing that. These kids are like way behind. Because they basically, in Georgia, a year at least in most places, but some places like 2 years or more, they weren't going to school.
A lot of times they couldn't even get a hold of the teacher until they
yeah.
later.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's crazy. So there is something to be said for human interaction. And again, I'm not against technology. We're broadcasting right now, right? And we're putting it on the internet. But I don't think that should replace it. You know, like, I even talk to people now, like, and where do you go to church? Well, this is so-and-so church, but we just watch it online. It's like, okay. All right, I guess it's better than nothing. But, I mean, it's like you're missing so much if you just choose to watch it on your computer or TV. Yeah, well, and as Lutherans, again, these are mostly folks that are, like, they don't place an emphasis on the sacraments. You know, and honestly, just these like big mega church things, I mean, you're missing out on fellowship and talking to people, but it's like, well, the main thing is whatever the pastor's teaching you in the sermon. Well, you can watch that on TV. Okay? But, with, like I said, when you correctly understand a lot of the importance is receiving communion, the sacrament, then we kind of need to be here to do that, right? So it's a little bit easier for us to say, you got to come to church instead of just watch on TV. And again, if you can't get out, if you can't, that's different than you're just choosing not to. Because see, if I don't drive to church and back, I don't have to talk to people. I can get on the golf course earlier. I can get in the lake earlier. I can watch the NFL pregame, right? Because I'm not spending, you know, I think this is what you say, well, just tune into the service. And the problem with that is then it becomes very easy, like one Sunday, I think I'll just skip it this week. You know, I want to get out even earlier or whatever. So it's kind of a slippery slope. So again, I'm not against the technology, but I think there is something to be said, like John is saying 2,000 years ago, and it hasn't changed. Okay, letters are great, emails are great, Facebook's great, but it's not the same as me right here with you having a conversation, and where we can actually, like, you know, touch each other and just share a cup of coffee and donut together or whatever people bring. There's something about that. God has created us to be interactive creatures. Okay, yeah.
I was just going to say that one thing that used to, I never tried to get anything important across the first time, you know, because there's no dialogue.
Yeah, there's no dialogue. And it can be misunderstood very easily, too.
Absolutely. And the best thing is to see them face to face, because sometimes, even on the phone, you don't get their expressions and things.
That's it.
You read court.
That's it. So much of communication is nonverbal. Okay, how many times have you tried to read an email or a text and you're like, are they mad at me? Because it's like really short, you know, or whatever. It's like, are they just busy? I mean, you don't know. Like, if you were there with them, you could kind of get more of a read on if they're frustrated or whatever, right? See y'all laugh. This has happened to you guys.
Well, even just wearing a mask. And I'll be talking, they'll look at me like, you talking to me?
Yeah, you can't see, right? You can't see the expression.
And then they can communicate.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's real. You know, God, of course, knew what he was doing, but, you know, we see this because we need this interaction with people, okay? Everything can't, if it's all digitized, it's not healthy. Again, that can be a tool to help us, but it can't replace interaction. Yeah.
It reminds me of, okay, well, why be a teacher? Just bring them all into class and say, read the book.
Yes. Yeah.
And then what did they get out of it?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's a whole other thing. they don't want us to talk to the kids too much. It's like, well, how am I building relationships with them and teaching them? And what I've discovered, if you just tell them to do that, they learn less. You know, they learn less because some of them aren't going to do it. And even if they do it, they're not going to understand it the same way as it is explained to them. Okay? Now, how does he close the letter here? Before we chase too many rabbits here, but I think we've made the point. 2,000 years later, it's still better to interact with people if you can, right? Again, some people can't, and that's different than just choosing not to. You know, why are people so miserable? I think because they're holed up in their house on their electronics all the time. They're not really interacting with human beings in the same way. Okay. Well, and then how does he end it? He gives them a greeting. He says, peace, right? He's going to speak to them and he's going to say, peace be unto you. Okay. And he says, our friends salute you, greet you, and friends in my name, by name. Now the name there he closes with, as what name do we bear as God's people? Christians. We bear the name Christian, right? And are even in the old days, a lot of times, you know, and I guess it can still happen today, if people converted to Christianity at their baptism, they took on a new name. Okay, they took on a Christian name, so to speak. Okay? All right? So I love that stuff he's closing with there. You know, we're gonna get together in person. We're going to speak face to face, and he's giving them peace. We give you greetings as friends. And then we're going to greet each other by name, our name in Christ, okay? Just real quickly, if there's anything we need to add on the last page, since truth and love are two major themes of these two letters, we want to think about how truth and love function in our life in the church today. Truth and love are not supposed to be opposed to each other, but inseparable from each other. No one can keep one without the other. To what concentrate acts of love do you think the truths of Christianity should lead? Well, John talks about this. So if we truly love, what should that lead to? Caring for our brother, right? He keeps coming back to that. If you don't love your brother, you can't love God, right? So caring for one another as the church, again, that's harder to do if we don't ever actually interact with each other. Helping others, supporting the congregation. Any others that you want to add there? Then the last question, how would you respond? This is a good one to close with, maybe. How would you respond to someone who claims that the church should focus on acts of love and not worry about the truth? Oh man, that's a popular thing today. Just love people, man. This church needs to just love people. Don't talk about all this doctrine stuff. Don't even use the word doctrine. That sounds kind of dusty and old fashioned. You know, that may turn people off. Deeds, not creeds. Okay, that's like a popular saying here. So what's the problem with that when somebody says that? How do you respond to that?
The deeds are actions. You're doing something.
Okay.
Whereas creeds, it's an action that you believe in something, and you're gonna honor that.
Mm-hmm.
It's two different deeds.
Okay. Okay, Dick, did you want to add to that? That's good.
I was just going to say that the Bible speaks a lot about truth, but love is kind of understood. I mean, we see acts of love and so on and so forth, but the truth is really what they're trying to get across is what the truth is. Mm-hmm. I am the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I am the way and I am the life. And then, he didn't say love. He said, I love you, but I am the way, the truth, and the life. And so truth is really well defined. Love is kind of something that
people may define in different ways. Did you want to add to that too?
Well, it's a little different. A lot of people love this world, but they do not believe in the truth that God created.
Yeah.
And it goes together.
Okay. Yeah.
The Greeks decided different ways that love meant. Mm-hmm. Now they have different words for love.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I think what they're doing there, and again, this is very popular in contemporary American Christianity, is you're setting up the old trick of the false dichotomy. Okay, a false dichotomy is where you say it's either got to be this or that. Kind of like people do with Jesus. It's like, they'll say, well, he's got to be a man or he's got to be God. No, that's a false dichotomy. He's both. Just like they'll say, well, you got to love or you got to have truth. No, that's a false dichotomy. What have we learned lessons? We've got to have both. Right? The answer is not an either or. It's not truth without love, and it's not love without truth, because you really can't truly have this. I think a lot of the stuff y'all were saying ties into that. So that's why I'd say you're setting up a false dichotomy and saying, what's that? Then you explain, saying, well, you're saying it's got to be one or the other. No, the church, we need to stand firmly on the truth, but we also need to love people. Because, if you read these little letters John wrote, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John in the Bible, you're going to understand that. He's saying you can't have true love without, I just did it, right? You can't really have love without truth. Right? But you can't really have truth without love either. That's not good either. If you have this wonderful doctrinal statement, but you're not loving and taking care of your brother, you're missing something. But then again, if you're just helping people all the time and there's no truth behind it, then you're missing something too. Okay? So it's really a false dichotomy, but you hear that a lot today. Oh, we're just going to love on people. We're just going to love people. And that's great. Okay, but you got to have truth too. Why are you loving people? Well, then we have to understand the truth. Right? Okay? All right. Went a few minutes over, but we finished the whole lesson. So this concludes the study of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Again, very heavily on 1st John, but I wanted to spend at least a couple weeks on 2nd and 3rd John because they had some great questions in here, but as I was reading, there's even, more stuff they didn't. It's almost like they're like, we got to do this in one lesson, but it's like, well, we can make a lesson on each one. It's okay. And because there's a lot of other good stuff in there too, in these short books. All right. Anything else? Oh, unless you want to.
No.
Tonight, we didn't have the opening. We just did Bible study. So why don't we stand and close the Lord's Prayer? How about that? We can sing if y'all.